This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. We find ourselves at an extraordinary crossroads today in the United States. While anger against racist violence and economic injustice is at a boiling point, a segment of American society is so vehemently frightened of losing power and privilege that it is determined to elect a demagogic farce of a candidate. It might feel to progressives that we're fighting defensively just to preserve the modest gains we have won. But my guest, Bill Ayers, who knows a thing or two about political organizing, says that perhaps we are lacking the confidence to imagine achieving our wildest, most radical dreams. His new book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto, has been lauded by Angela Davis as one that, quote, should be read by everyone who wants to believe that another world is possible. Bill Ayers is a distinguished professor of education and senior university scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, now retired. Once upon a time, he was the co-founder of the Weather Underground Movement, a radical organization that sought to end the Vietnam War. He is also the author of Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and he now joins me to discuss his latest book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So first, let's talk about how this idea came to you for this book to begin with. It's very easy for us who are progressives to lose sight of the gains we have made over the last few decades and to feel like we're constantly on the defensive, as I mentioned earlier. And your book, whose title is actually a Che Guevara quote, I think is a really timely challenge. And you talk about getting the idea to do the book from an elderly Greek anarchist named Manolis Glezos. Tell us how the book sort of blossomed, where it began.
Well, I'll tell you the story of Glezos, but the book came from many, many sources. But first, I was in Greece. I was invited to Greece to give a talk to a group of to a convention of Greek anarchists, which I thought was a contradiction in terms. I said to them when they picked me up, "Are you sure you're anarchist? Because you're having a convention." But I had a wonderful time in Athens, and through a mutual friend in Chicago, I spent a day with an extraordinary man named Manolis Glezos, who is in his now mid-90s, and as recently as 3 months ago, I read his name in the New York Times as having been arrested in front of the Greek parliament. So he's an activist for a long, long time. But he's quite famous in Europe, and especially in Greece, for an act that he undertook when he was 14 years old. He climbed up on the Acropolis and tore the Nazi flag off the Acropolis, and the occupying forces sentenced him to death, and he was pursued and eventually arrested and tortured. But Manolis has kept the faith and been an activist, an organizer, a radical, an anarchist socialist for all those years. And my day with him was extraordinary in many ways, but what you're referring to is when we were walking back to the boat, he said to me, you know, I think the biggest obstacle to making the kinds of humane changes that we need to make in Greece, and I'd wager in the United States as well, has to do with our lack of confidence. We don't really trust ourselves. We don't see another world as possible, and we don't trust ourselves to run our own affairs without presidents and generals and chiefs of police and so on. And I took that seriously. I thought that, wow, this is a man who has a century of activism under his belt, who's done courageous things as well as everyday organizing things like the rest of us. And he's saying to me, what we need is confidence. What we need is imagination. And that's very much what the book is about.
So you organize it into various chapters that are broken up by sort of issue that first lays out how kind of what the depressing statistics are, but then challenges us to really imagine another way of looking at it. Opening with the military, the U.S. military, the biggest military, most well-funded military in the world, biggest chunk of our taxes goes towards the military. And, you know, every now and then you see these statistics and these sort of conjectures where if we, you know, the cost of a single military fighter jet could, you know, put a solar panel on the roof of every house in California, et cetera. So we do think about how much money we're wasting on our military. But what, you know, why is the military your opening issue? Why is it, and most Americans don't even talk about it that much. It doesn't come up in the debates. If anything, it usually comes up, let's spend more on the military.
Exactly. Well, the problem with the debates, of course, is that the issues that I care about, and I think the issues of a majority of people care about, aren't really in the framing. And in many ways, that's what the book is about. It's about reframing several important issues so that we can talk about what we want to talk about, not what's on offer from the 1% or from the political class. So, for example, in medicine, you know, the debate between Obamacare or returning to a fully predatory health insurance companies running the health system, I want to talk about free universal health care for all. It's an attempt to reframe and rewrite the issues that we should talk about. Why did I begin with the military? Because the United States, it's true, we don't talk about military adventures abroad as much as we should because we don't have to. And one of the things that privilege does is that it anesthetizes us to what other people are experiencing. So we have a $1 trillion military annual budget, and we are involved in permanent war all over the world. And this is something that we have to take seriously and take responsibility for. It not only destroys other countries in remarkable and horrifying ways, but it also undermines our sense of being a nation among nations, a people among people, and a vibrant living democracy.
I wonder, you know, if we got itemized tax bills every year when we filed our taxes and saw just how much of the money that is taken out of our paychecks goes towards the military, we might think very differently about how much money is wasted, at least from that perspective. Like, even if we're not at the receiving end of bombs and violence, the fact that we're paying for all of this hardware, much of which is never even used, ought to certainly offend us, selfishly, at least speaking.
That's true. And we're living in a moment when war and empire are unapologetically supported by the people in power. I don't think that represents where most of us stand. And I think we need to build and mobilize a mass movement to shine a bright light on it and to bring it to an end.
Well, many people have characterized what is happening in the streets of American cities as a war as well, particularly if you look at the militarization of our police. A lot of army surplus tanks and other hardware, war fighting hardware, is simply given to police departments around the country. And African Americans rightly feel as though sometimes they are on the receiving end of a war against them. How important is that, or sort of imagining something different? It feels like the Black Lives Matter movement has really helped this country imagine a very, very different society when, we really need to be demanding, Black people shouldn't be killed by police and constantly deemed guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I think you are exactly right. I think one of the exciting things about living here and now, and certainly in Chicago, but I think in the Bay Area as well, is that the Black Lives Matter is the latest iteration of a centuries-old Black freedom movement. And it's on the rise, and it's exciting. And yes, it is targeting the occupying force of a militarized police enterprise. But at the same time, it's targeting education. It's targeting mental health. It's targeting mass incarceration. So the wonderful thing about the Black Lives Matter movement, and it's not the only movement that's reshaping and redefining what we should be talking about, but it's an important one. It's a central one. But the important thing is that it brings together many, many issues and reframes them so that we can think about what are our priorities. In terms of the police, I have a chapter called Stop the Cops. Each chapter is kind of a bumper sticker. And I'm making the argument that these are not, it says demand the impossible. And that's meant to be somewhat ironic because actually each of the things that I put forward are quite possible. It's a matter of whether we can mobilize and demand that these things happen in a way that suits human interests. So in terms of the police, it's not just a matter of demilitarizing the police. It's a matter of rethinking what does public safety mean in a free society? Why would we have 40% of our budget in the city of Chicago go to policing? And Chicago is such a great example because Mayor Rahm Emanuel closed 52 schools a couple of years ago, last spring laid off 1,000 teachers, and 2 weeks ago hired 1,000 police officers. That's a recipe for social suicide, and the Black Lives Matter leaders and kids get this, and they are bringing it for us to see and to organize around.
You have a chapter in your book simply titled Abolition. And this is an idea that has been bandied about for a while, but hasn't really crept into mainstream discourse around the issue of mass incarceration, which is another blight on American society. There has been a, you know, sort of strong vocal minority demanding that we imagine what it would look like to have a completely reformed criminal justice system and prison industrial system to the point where we might even someday imagine abolishing that system altogether. That seems impossible sometimes.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, how could our society function without prisons? Where would we put the criminals?
I love that you're raising this. You know, the way you put it, you know, it seems so far outside of the mainstream discourse. We haven't yet been able to talk about it. If you go back to 1840, you would say the same thing about the abolitionists who were advocating the end of slavery. It was an outrageous idea. It was an idea that was so preposterous because slavery was so much the prop of the entire economic system. And the most valuable resource in the United States in 1850 was enslaved human beings. So it's impossible in one moment, and then a little while later, it's not impossible. This question of prison abolition is something that I have come to understand very strongly because of the leadership of people like Angela Davis and Erica Miners and Ruthie Gilmore and Bernadine Dorn, who have explained it to me and really made me see the ways in which we limit what we're willing to fight for if we don't go all the way and say, we do not need this institution of congealed violence everywhere in our country in order to be good and free people. So you ask the question, where do we put the criminals? I actually put that question to a student in an audience when he challenged my notion that we could abolish the prisons. And this young man had encyclopedic knowledge of John Wayne Gacy, a mass murderer from Illinois. And after he spoke for 10 minutes, I said, okay, I give up. We can have one prison cell. And then I said, I'll add two more, Bush and Cheney. Now we've got three, but we don't have 2.5 million. When we start from the specific and we say, as soon as we get into the place where we say wrongdoing or illegal acts or mistakes equals punishment and punishment equals prison, we're on the wrong territory. We should be talking about alternatives to prison. And I list out about 1,000 of them in the book, but there's many, many ways we could rethink caging people as the last of a long, long line of things we could do to make sure that prisons aren't necessary.
I mean, even bringing the prisons in line with their own labels would be a start, such as correctional and rehabilitation. I mean, most of them are the exact opposite of correctional and rehabilitative, and they end up doing the opposite.
Yes, those words have become hypocritical euphemisms. What we really do need is we need to start from the bottom up again and say, what kind of institutions, what kinds of programs, what kinds of projects could we institute that would make the society safer, more vibrant, more participatory, more open? And frankly, when you stop and think, what could we do instead of caging people? You begin with good schools and jobs. You go to mental health clinics and drug rehabilitation. You go to all kinds of alternatives to caging, in terms of work kinds of programs, or most importantly, restorative justice. If harm is done, the perpetrator of harm has to restore the harmed party to wholeness. That's not impossible to think about. It's done in many places in small scales. We could do it in a much larger way.
And by the way, I should just give a shout out to the brand new documentary by Ava DuVernay on Netflix called 13th, From Slave to Criminal with One Amendment. And she really traces the rise of the mass incarceration system in the U.S. All the way back to slavery. It's a really powerful documentary.
Yeah, it's a wonderful documentary, and the 13th Amendment is what begins the chapter I wrote on abolition, because absolutely people don't know that when we abolish slavery, we said except for the commission of crime, and then in the afterlife of slavery, crime was everything from loitering to being unemployed, and that's what rose, created the Jim Crow system, the lynching system, and mass incarceration.
Let's talk about one of the most important issues that gets discussed a lot, but to which I think, which might provide the biggest obstacle to the left, and that's the issue of our system of economics. So there have been many books written about redefining the way our economy is organized. In mainstream discourse, it seems to just be this dichotomy between dictatorial socialism and free market capitalism. You know, people like Michael Albert have written books about reorganizing the economy. But the main issue is that something's got to give, right? Something needs to be done. We have just skyrocketing income inequality, which should be enough of an indictment against capitalism globally, but somehow isn't. How do you take on this issue in your book? How do we demand a completely radical, different sort of economy that really does benefit the 99% instead of just the 1%?
Well, each of the issues that I take up, whether it's mass incarceration or healthcare or education or environmental catastrophe, each issue ends up wondering about what can we survive with capitalism intact. And the environmental chapter borrows heavily from Naomi Klein, who says at some point, we can either save capitalism and destroy the earth, or we can destroy capitalism and save the earth. And I think that it is time for us to reimagine what socialism could look like in the 21st century. There's a lot of people doing work on this and a lot of good work being done. But the important issue that we have to argue about is we have to win the political argument. We have to win the conversation about what is a desirable way to live. If we are stuck in predatory capitalism and constant kind of accumulation of goods and the privatizing of everything, we are doomed as a people. If we find ways to cooperate and to share the social wealth, we're in much better shape. And that is a big argument underneath everything in the book.
How can we examine the way in which vulnerable workers have organized to draw lessons from them? You discuss in your book the work of the Domestic Workers Alliance, a really powerful organization led by immigrant women. What sort of models do they offer?
Well, I think Ai-Jen Poo and others who've been organizing domestic workers show us a lot of different ways that we could reimagine work. And we could imagine it as something that's socially necessary, that's something that's shared, something that is humane and human-sized. And I'm very excited about several organizing projects underway. Domestic workers is one. There was a great movement here around a windows and doors factory that tried to shut down and move to pick up cheaper labor, and the workers occupied the plant. Just last night, the Chicago Teachers Union, which is one of the most progressive public sector unions in the country, fighting for public education, and they just made an agreement last night. They just came to a settlement, tentative settlement. But what's terrific about watching them organize is that they are really a social movement disguised as a labor conflict. They really are fighting for public education, for the idea of public education, which is under pretty constant assault. So I see models everywhere of people organizing, workers organizing, to demand what seems impossible, but in an era of rampant individualism and austerity and all the backwardness that we're facing, privatization, there are people standing up and fighting back. And I think things are moving in the right direction in that regard.
My guest is Bill Ayers, Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, now retired. We're discussing his book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. His earlier book was called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. So much to discuss. So we're going to keep Bill on for an extended version of this conversation, which you can get in the on-demand premium content section of our website. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and that website is risingupwithsonali.com. You can also find us at Twitter at twitter.com/ruwithsonali. So, Bill, let's turn to the issue of college debt. You have a chapter titled Jubilee, simply entitled Jubilee, which is a wonderful way of imagining what it would look like in a country where people didn't have to go into debt to get a higher education system. I don't know, we can simply go to a place like Germany to imagine that. But it did come up during this election season, at least while Bernie Sanders was in the running as a Democratic candidate for the nomination of the Democratic Party. Is this an idea that that we could realize even faster than we think?
Oh, I think it's absolutely within our reach. It's, again, a question of priorities, what we want to spend money on, what we think is valuable. And the big thing is to have the argument about whether education, this is a question I would have asked if I were Lester Holt to the candidates. I would have said, is education a human right or is education a product to be sold at the marketplace? If you see Michael Moore's new movie, Where to Invade Next, there's a wonderful section where he goes to a country where higher education is free. And he finds two American students who are studying there. And he says to them, he says to some of the local kids, well, shouldn't the foreign kids at least pay? Because that would bring down the debt. And they say, very quickly, these young people, 20 years old, 21 years old, and they say to him, but education is not a product. If we concede that education is a product, it's a slippery slope, and we'll all be paying before long. So, yes, I think that debt has to be, debt is entangling, and debt is also a promise that you will pay back in the future what you're borrowing now. That means an ever-expanding consumerist society. It's something that's unsustainable. Once again, I think we can decide whether we're going to live as a nation among nations, whether we're going to live in balance with the earth, whether we're going to live in a way that allows everyone to get meaningful work to do, a good education, decent healthcare, or not. If we agree that those are decent goals, the practical matter of getting there is not that hard.
I love how in your book you open each chapter with these very succinct statistics that really ought to kind of shock us. And you have a chapter on healthcare, which is another one of those issues that I think is within reach in terms of demanding the impossible.
Absolutely.
Because we've had a conversation in this country where the terms single-payer healthcare have actually been mentioned in the mainstream media. Bernie Sanders again helped also to popularize that. Even Bill Clinton recently talked about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which was supposed to be the panacea for our private health insurance system. And he said that it is riddled with problems. He sort of admitted it in one of his sort of standard off-the-cuff moments where he actually reveals what he's thinking. So healthcare in this country as a right, how would you characterize this issue to somebody, even say from the Republican Party, because we all need healthcare. It shouldn't be a partisan issue.
Well, you know, we all need healthcare, and it's a matter of whether you think there is such a thing as society. You know, you remember the famous comment by Margaret Thatcher, there is no such thing as society. And her other famous comment, there is no alternative. The reality is there are many alternatives, and society is critically important. Deep within our DNA, as well as deep within our American culture, is a war or a contradiction or a conflict between individual and society. And both are valuable. And we need to understand that we are both, each of us, every one of us is an individual, the one and only. And at the same time, we are just like everybody else, and we share a community. So the question we have to debate is and discuss is what parts of our world should we share? The triumph of individualism in the last three decades has meant that education is a product, and it's something that you should get for yourself or your family and pay for, that public safety is owning your own gun, and so on. It goes right down that healthcare is taking care of yourself and being sure to take your vitamins. But in reality, we are all in this together, and the basic human rights for life, liberty, a healthy body, an education that's up to the standards of your community. All these things are things that are within our reach. Healthcare is such an obvious one because we not only have Medicare, which is a flawed but necessary kind of free health care for all, or it's in that direction. We have the Veterans Administration hospitals, which are a form of socialized medicine. We need to take it much further. Bernie Sanders talks about Medicare for all. Medicare is not perfect. I think we need to say free health care for all. It should be within our, it is within our reach financially and practically. It's just a matter of political will as to whether we get there. But again and again, this moment we're living in comes down to, you know, it's not just recently with Bernie Sanders. In 2008, when the right wing kept calling Obama a socialist, they polled young people, and people 18 to 25 had a more favorable view of socialism than they did over the Republican Party. That's truer today than it was then. I can imagine some kid in Iowa Googling the word socialism and seeing that it's from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs, and saying, wow, that's Christian. And it kind of is. I mean, it's kind of a common sense thing when you look at it that way. And it's how every family, you know, functions. Every family, you know, takes from the people who can provide and gives to the people, even if they're a year old or if they're disabled or whatever. It's not that complicated. It's a matter of political will.
Well, Bill, finally, let's end with the topic of education, which I'm sure is close to your heart. You're a professor of education. You have a chapter in your book entitled Teach Freedom. And it really feels like that is a good starting point for us to begin imagining and demanding the impossible, that when we are all educated about imagining these new ways, or sometimes even old ways of organizing society, that's when we can start to make it actually happen. But it's not just, I mean, our conversations around education in the mainstream usually get relegated to paying teachers or not, charter schools versus not. But what about how we teach and even what we teach? How important is it for us to really think of our schools as raising critical thinkers?
Exactly. Well, one of the, where I start with this, and I start with that little statistical index that you referenced, and in the education chapter, it begins by noting how much the city of Washington, D.C. pays per child for basic education, and it contrasts that with Sidwell Friends, where the Obama children went to school. And it's, you know, three times as much. It's outrageous that the most privileged people in this country get an education that is out of reach for other children. So I start from the idea that, again, let's talk about what would education be in a free society for free people in a democracy. And my basic argument is that in a free society, the fullest development of everyone is the condition for the full development of anyone. And that's based on a precious and fragile ideal that every human being is of incalculable value. So that's where I begin. And that has implications for policy, obviously. It means that, you know, whatever the richest and most privileged people have for their children should be the baseline that we want for all of our children in the community. And so you look at somebody like Arnie Duncan. He was 7 years the superintendent of Chicago schools, 7 years the secretary of education. And just this year, he moved back to Chicago and couldn't find a single school for his children, because he's not going to send his kids to a school without arts, without sports, without libraries, without nurses, without counselors. And yet that's the school he expects the rest of us to send our kids to. We have to fight against that. In terms of curriculum, which is what you were angling towards, I think, in a free society, we would foreground the attributions, the arts of liberty, or the attributions that allow people to be free. Qualities like creativity, imagination, entrepreneurship, initiative, courage. We would not foreground obedience and conformity, which are the hallmarks of every educational system in a dictatorship or an autocracy. We want freedom. We want imagination. But our schools too often are tangled up in other ways of thinking about learning that aren't really models of learning for free people.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Best of luck to you with the book.
Thank you, Sonali. I look forward to seeing you again, and thanks for having me on.
My guest is Bill Ayers, Distinguished Professor of Education and Senior University Scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago, now retired. And we've been discussing his latest book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. His earlier book was called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RU with Sonali.